a sacred story that is a sacred thing unto itself is not the same as Bible. It's not the same as some of the other things that are present in European ways of thinking, because spirituality is different. So I really don't know how I would translate that word, for example. So in Anishinaabemowin, most things are derived from verbs. So the vast majority of words are verbs. There's no adjectives. Everything is based on verbal construction, and so that changes how people envisage language. There's a gender system that's animate and inanimate. Everything is marked as animate and inanimate, like in French, how everything's masculine or feminine. Mm-hmm. And so that informs our understanding of our relations with the natural world.
Welcome to the Earth Ideas podcast. Interviews with academics, scientists, and journalists about their areas of research. Subscribe now, wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to rate and review this episode if you found it valuable. And you can also support me with caffeine to keep them coming through my Buy Me a Coffee link.
Well, thank you so much, Lindsay, for making the time to chat to me today. I think as we sort of emailed the last few months trying to arrange this, so I'm very appreciative to get to talk to you. One thing, the reason for my contacting you personally is my interest, particularly in Indigenous languages, and obviously, as my work, a lot of my work involves sort of conservation of natural things. When you work in that, you can't help but stumble into the realm of conservation of languages and cultures that are also being sort of, I don't want to say like attacked, but maybe like kind of forgotten, you know, and sort of like, I myself have realized to draw that into this umbrella of appreciating the biodiversity of the world, and it definitely fits under that. So I mean, and for you, you're First Nation, so I wanted to ask if you know, whether for you it was like wanting to learn about your heritage and culture and language became a part of that, or whether it was like language was sort of your first love and then it just made sense that that Indigenous languages would end up being something that you specialized in.
Yeah. Well, going back to the first thing that you said, I think attacked is actually the right word. Like colonization, the colonial process, imperialism have been direct attacks on Indigenous peoples and Indigenous lands. And the current state of Indigenous languages globally is a direct result of colonial policy, purposeful colonial policy and stated policy. So I think that that's something that we need to continue having conversations about in terms of the legacy of colonization and how that has been devastating for Indigenous community. In terms of my interest in languages, my family knew that we had Indigenous heritage. We knew we were Indigenous, but because of colonial forces and significant racism and some of the colonial experiences that my family had, we didn't have the culture, we didn't talk about it. But I was really lucky to be able to go study linguistics at First Nations University, which is a campus of the University of Regina, or like a federated college of the University of Regina and other universities in Saskatchewan. The focus there is on decolonized education. So there's an emphasis on Indigenous professors. We only studied, not only, but primarily studied Indigenous languages. To do graduate work there, you have to be doing Indigenous work. And so I'm really grateful, because it was actually through that decolonized education that I was able to reclaim our heritage from my family. And so it's not just me, but it's intercalated through our entire family. I'm really grateful for that. And then, of course, from that education, the necessity and wisdom of Indigenous languages became increasingly apparent.
Yeah. So at what point did you become fluent in it? What is the language that what languages do you speak?
I'm a mixed heritage person, and I accept that I'm a victim and a beneficiary of colonization. And so I feel it's important to understand that and live that. So I speak all my heritage languages. which are French, German, fluent, but I'm working on Anishinaabemowin, which is also called, we're Algonquin, but it's also called Ojibwe, Potawatomi, Soto, Chippewa. There's a few communities within the broader Anishinaabe nation that are sometimes referred to individually, but Anishinaabemowin is the language. And then I also speak Spanish and some Italian, not particularly well, but I'm a linguist.
You have a love for it as well, obviously. I feel like that's one thing about learning a language, right? You have to really love speaking it and have the opportunity to speak it, right?
Yeah, and that's been interesting in terms of urban language revitalization, that we have worked really hard to create space in an urban context to reassert that the territory that we're on is our traditional territory and that our languages belong here. Which I think is, that effort contains real teachings and really important knowledge about how our languages fit in terms of like modern urban life, which they absolutely do.
Yeah. Are there public settings that you can go and know that you'll be able to find other people that speak Anishinaabe know it?
Yeah. So we have a language nest. We have the Kingston Indigenous Languages Nest. So we're really lucky. We have some amazing community leaders who collaborated a few years ago. It's been about 8 years since we started it. I was lucky to be at that table. And we started with just family events on weekends. And then we established as the Kingston Indigenous Languages Nest, and it's become, I think, quite important in the local community. We have evening classes, immersion weekends. We continue with our family weekends. So that's a lot of fun. We have pumpkin carving this weekend, and we're going to sing some songs. And we do both languages. We're on shared territory. Because the idea of the nation state is different, right? So there's flow. And having that, we have a treaty that governs this land that insists that we have both Anishinaabemowin and Mohawk present. We've brought in other languages too that are present in our urban community, but mostly we focus on those two.
So but if you were to go to, say, like a shop or a restaurant, would it be, is the goal one day to be able to sort of how you would in Europe, you know, you can easily walk in there and speak English in any bar and restaurant and someone would be able to work it out. Is that the goal?
That would be ideal. I'm not sure that that's where we're gonna end up. I think for me, the goal would be to see the language used in social domains that are Indigenous, right? So at community gatherings, certainly in primarily Indigenous communities. So in the city, we're only about 4% of the local population. So I'm not sure I'm ever going to be able to walk into Walmart and speak Anishinaabemowin. Although I've seen people do it, and I love that.
For real? Really?
It is our language. This is our land, so it belongs there. Particularly people who are doing immersion, but like, yep, they'll muddle through. It's not mutually intelligible, of course, with English. They're totally unrelated. So that's a challenge, but I think a good opportunity too. But yeah, for me, I would like to see it expanded to reasonably fluent speech within our community so that we can affirm our language and identity amongst ourselves.
I think it's absolutely something to go for. And as you were saying, walk into a shop and sort of say, it's been spoken here before, you know, for hundreds, thousands of years in some form before English and Western language as well. Like if you go to, you were saying before that you lived in Oxford for a time. I don't know if you made it to Wales, but if you go there, like the Welsh, all the signs have the Welsh translation on. And I'm not sure how many people in Wales actually speak fluent Welsh, but they make it a point that this language is not going anywhere, you know?
I really admire that. And if they can do it, we can do it, right? There are 100,000 Anishinaabe in Canada. We can, and in the United States, we can make this happen. I have full faith that our language is not a dying language. And it's the language that comes from this land, and so it will continue to be here.
Yeah, absolutely. Are there sort of different approaches for teaching kids and teaching adults? Are you finding that you can sort of approach kids more easily with the language by teaching it in schools or anything like that?
Absolutely. I've been really lucky to work with a community on Manitoulin Island where there's a really high Anishinaabe population, and they have worked so hard to ensure that language and culture pervade life on Manitoulin. And so having worked with a school there, originally it was a pilot project called the Mininu Minising Anishinaabe Numagegmig, which is the Manitoulin Island Anishinaabe school. Mm-hmm. It's now been incorporated into Lakeview School and Chiking First Nations. We have several years of longitudinal data about this that my collaborator, Stephanie Roy, and I have collected. And it's shown really positive results in terms of what the community has achieved for self-determined education and language revitalization. So we have kids who came in not speaking the language who at the end of grade four were testing with a fairly high degree of fluency, which I think is a remarkable achievement. And I'm really excited to see that. In an urban context, it's a little bit more difficult. So we look to them as really the people who are setting the benchmarks on excellence in Indigenous ed. Here it's a lot because the Indigenous population is so spread out. So for example, my son is one of only, it looks like I can actually see a school, but my son is one of only about five children in his school who are Indigenous.
Right.
Out of about 300 children. So it's very spread out. So having an immersion program in one school is something that we need to work towards, but there are logistical challenges. I don't think it's unachievable. Mm. We've been lucky to partner with the school board to bring in language into some of the schools where there's higher populations. So I'm excited about that.
Does it could be taught as a second language even in schools where there are no indigenous children, right? Like, you know, most schools offer language as a course. And I mean, in Canada, isn't quite a lot of, don't quite a lot of schools offer French from a very early age because of obviously the colonial legacy there.
Yeah, and that's an interesting thing. So French is offered throughout. Everybody takes core French up to about grade nine, and you can also do French immersion. And I think that's great, and the more languages, the better. But at the same time, part of that is based in a mythology surrounding two founding nations in Canada, which is a really Eurocentric mythology that leaves out the importance of the 60 or so Indigenous languages that have been present on this land forever. Mm-hmm. And so I think that is something that we need to continue having conversations about in terms of how do we ensure that not just the colonial languages and legacy are honored, but that the enduring presence of Indigenous people is also represented in schools through language education. And I would love to see that. There's curriculum in Ontario for the languages that are present here, but it's very difficult to find provincial schools, particularly in urban centers with lower Indigenous populations, that offer them.
Yeah.
We just need to keep pushing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think as well, what you were saying right at the beginning, you said attacked really is actually quite a good word for it. Like, there's this is a quite a highly charged sort of thing once you dig into it. The cultural genocide in the US and in Canada was definitely purposeful, right? And you know, do you feel like people with Indigenous heritage are conscious of that? Is it something that, you know, you can get people angry about, or is most Indigenous people just kind of like, I don't know, like okay about it, about just speaking English? What have you found?
No, people aren't okay about it. I think we are all aware of it because we've lived it, right? The intergenerational trauma that we've inherited through colonial policies is real for pretty much every Indigenous person that I've ever met. Hmm. There are very few people who would say that what has happened is acceptable. Particularly the legacy of residential schools and the just 150 years of abuse that took place in those schools. Cultural abuse and physical and sexual abuse were very, very common. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think it's among Indigenous populations that the issue is, but the problem is that everything, in spite of policies of self-determination for Indigenous education, Indigenous people, is controlled by government. And so everything's cap in hand, it's often grant-based, and it depends on the women. And I'm really frustrated by that because I think along the political spectrum, there's a lot of difference in terms of awareness and support. Mm. So it depends on what kind of government you've got. And I'm seeing an improvement in awareness amongst non-Indigenous people, particularly since the end of our Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which ended in 2015. Mm-hmm. And there was a set of recommendations called the Calls to Action that were released at that time. So there have been more discussions about it and more awareness, but I think that that needs to be followed up with actual action. Mm. Our current government promised that they would bring in policy regarding all of the 94 calls to action. That has not happened. So that's something that we really need to address as a mainstream population, because it can't be up to Indigenous people to undo our own oppression, particularly when mainstream people continue to benefit from those colonial policies.
As well, because of sort of the way that history and knowledge is shared among Indigenous groups, right? It's even more sort of like critical, really, that these languages are preserved, mm-hmm. because so very little history from before colonialism was written down, right?
And that's an interesting mythology in terms of colonial mentality. So the idea that Indigenous people, because there weren't pervasive writing systems, have no recorded history, was actually a tool of colonization in order to present Indigenous peoples and also enslaved peoples from Africa as being people without history, and therefore simpler and not as sophisticated as European populations. But when you look at it, we actually do have a good deal of recorded history. So oral history has been accepted in Canadian courts as being mm-hmm. valid. And that's the primary way that history is shared. But there are also ways that it's depicted. So there are scrolls, there are wampum belts. We have a wampum belt that governs this land as shared territory with the Haudenosaunee, primarily Mohawk people. So the Haudenosaunee Confederacy is a number of nations, but here most Haudenosaunee folks are Mohawk. There's Mohawk reserves. And we've had a treaty with them marked by a wampum belt since prior to colonization. So that's recorded history. There mm-hmm. are Lakota winter counts in the Great Plains that document history. So I think the more we learn about that kind of thing, the more we can really understand where colonialism presented things that were not true about Indigenous peoples in order to justify itself.
Yeah, and I think because of this importance of in oral histories, in having stories be told and talked through, it that just, again, mm-hmm. you can't, translating is so difficult, right? So without the language that story was made in, do you fear that it would be not the same story, or that things would be missing from that story if it was told in a different language?
Absolutely, that is extremely important. So even the way that we talk about stories, for example, in Anishinaabe Mo'en, as I understand it, there are two kinds of stories. There's T'bodjmwin, which are like our everyday stories, kinds of things I'm telling you right now. But then there's Atsukon, which are our sacred stories. It really gets my back up when people call them myths, because they're things that are actually part of living culture. Like, they're not like Greek myths. They're things that people still know to be true.
Right.
And they're living. And so that understanding of story as something sacred is very different from even Euro-Western concepts of things like the Bible. Mm. So having a language understanding of that allows you to look deeper into the culture and the spirituality and the way and the ontologies and epistemologies that are present here. And because language, I fully believe, influences the way that you see the world, when those things are translated into English, they do lose content and they lose perspective, because that perspective is then influenced by colonial ways of thinking.
Have you got any examples of these stories where it would be told two different ways?
There are rules about when and where stories are shared.
I see.
And it's not winter. So a lot of our sacred stories are told in the winter. It's not winter. So those are ones I probably wouldn't share in this context because of the publicness of it, and also because mm-hmm. of the rules around it. There's good reasons why those rules are in place. But even that kind of thing, understanding though that the reasoning behind that, it's not superstition, it's very logical. And that requires cultural understanding.
Right, that's so interesting. Yeah, absolutely, I completely. You were saying that, you know, you absolutely believe that language shapes the way that we see and understand the world. I mean, absolutely, mm-hmm. yeah. I mean, I came across a quote when sort of like thinking about this conversation that was like, there really is no such thing as a synonym. And it's so true, you know, like we try and think of other words and we're like, well, that's not quite it. And that means that, and that means that, and that kind of thing. And I mean, do you believe that there's really, other than the obvious, like a table, do you really believe that there are such things as like direct or true translations? Everything comes with sort of...
I would have to really think about that. But I think for the deep things, no. Like, I can't think of a word in English that means the same thing as what Atsukan means. Or like a sacred story that is a sacred thing unto itself is not the same as Bible. It's not the same as some of the other things that are present in European ways of thinking, because spirituality is different. So I really don't know how I would translate that word, for example. Mm. And even so, in Anishinaabemowin, most things are derived from verbs. So the vast majority of words are verbs. There's no adjectives. Everything is based on verbal construction. And so that changes how people envisage language. There's a gender system that's animate and inanimate. Everything is marked as animate and inanimate, like in French, how everything's masculine or feminine. Mm-hmm. And so that informs our understanding of our relations with the natural world. So things with a pulse tend to be animate. Mm-hmm. Obviously plants that are growing tend to be animate, but then there are sacred things like rocks are animate. So How does that change how we view the earth? Pipes, which are very sacred, are animate. And so that changes how we view that, that thing, which is so sacred to us. And you can see a difference. So if you go to the Pitt Rivers Museum in Oxford, there is, there's a Blackfoot sacred pipe in a drawer with a bunch of other pipes from all over the world, including like a pot pipe from Glastonbury. And that is so wrong and so indicative of how ways of conceiving of sacred items are just foundationally different.
Did you ever go and say to the curator, like, this is not right, these are two different things? Not even
I know thing. Conversations, I've never had them, but I'm aware that conversations have happened.
That's got to be a really massive part of what makes these languages different, right? Just walking around and feeling that different sort of connection to a thing. If we obviously with a tree, it's alive, it's connected to a whole bunch of other living things, and it has the ability to change and wane, and we change and wane with it. And then if you start to apply that to rocks, what other examples are there?
Other things that have been used in sacred practice, so kettles have had a place, and so they tend to be animate in Algonquian languages. So we have 11 language families in Canada. I'm really coming at it from an Algonquian perspective as an Anishinaabe Algonquian person. Mm-hmm. But that's another one. So you can see historical roots in these things. It's interesting to see what food plants are animate and which ones aren't. I don't quite know all the patterns there, but it's something I'm interested in.
How varied are the indigenous languages across America?
Night and day. So there are 58 language families, about 29, I believe, isolates. I'd have to double check that. In Canada, there's 3 language isolates and 11 families, and they're all completely unrelated. So they're as different from one another. Even so, Anishinaabemowin and Mohawk, which share a territory, are as grammatically, culturally different as English and Turkish.
What?
So like, absolutely, they're unrelated. They're from totally different root languages. So English is Indo-European, which is part of a really big family. It goes all the way from the UK and Ireland all the way to India. So it's a huge family that interspersed with other languages. So Europe has only 3, I believe, language families, 4 if you count Turkish. Mm-hmm. Whereas here we have 11 families, 60 languages. So the diversity is really incredible. And that gives us a lot of traditional ecological and land knowledge, cultural knowledge, that allows us to view the land in really different ways.
In Europe, you can kind of track where words have been borrowed and shared between different groups through, like, you know, from history, and you can sort of understand those relationships. Can we do the same thing with Indigenous language? Because of, you know, where shared territory was, were there people sharing words for the same things, or did they kind of meet across the divide and I don't know, communicate different ways?
Yeah, I think multilingualism was very common from what I understand. There's not a lot, I don't see very many Mohawk words, for example, in Anishinaabemowin, but there are similarities in some teachings. They're very, very culturally different, but there's definitely shared knowledges that tell you that like those treaties have been held sacred for a long time and people have been communicating with each other. I think, though, yeah, like definitely multilingualism. In some places there were common languages used. So in the Great Plains, there was a sign language, a fully developed sign language, just like ESL or ASL, that people were able to communicate in throughout different language groups because the languages are unrelated. So it's hard to pick up bits and pieces. But if everyone speaks the same sign, they're able to communicate across the three or four language families and six languages that are present. So that's really cool. And it's also interesting from an ability perspective because people who were deaf in those communities were also able to communicate in that language.
I really liked what you said earlier about the sort of like the grouping, like the Indo-European language stretched so far and covers so many different, it went down so many different routes, didn't it? And there are other many languages left that don't fit into these big groups.
Yep. So there's Haida, which if you've seen the Indigenous art that's black and white and red, Haida cultural art has been very, very popular globally because it's so beautiful. So that's a language isolate. I'm fairly sure Tlingit in northern British Columbia and into Alaska is, and then Kootenai, which is spoken in British Columbia, are language isolates. And then we have, in addition to those, eight different language families that are unrelated. And they're a varying size.
So it's called an isolate. That's interesting. Okay. Yeah. And so what kind of methods do you use to identify it, like in that way? What are the clues that you look for to say like, okay, this is a unique language. There's nothing that it's really like.
You use what are called cognates primarily. So you can look at grammatical patterns that are really common. So for example, Cree and Anishinaabemowin are closely related Algonquian languages. So it gets a bit confusing because Algonquin is a dialect of Anishinaabemowin, which is an Algonquian language. But I'm talking about Algonquian language family.
Okay.
I know, right? These are colonial terms and people didn't quite understand the striations. But so for example, in English or in Anishinaabemowin, one is Bejik. In Plains Cree, it's Bayak. So you can see a connection there, right? They sound similar, just like words that you can think of in German, egg is I, English egg. So, okay, that makes sense. I can see that those are connected words. And then you look at things like grammatical patterns. So English and German are both Germanic languages, and they both do things like case marking. Verbs are historically inflected very similarly. There's been language change, but you can see how they're related. And the same similarities are true. So you can reconstruct proto-Indigenous languages, like proto-Algonquian has been widely reconstructed. So if you look at a language and it doesn't jive, particularly with the languages around it, there's not grammatical similarities or vocabulary similarities that can't be accounted for by language contact, then you can be pretty sure you've got an isolate. I mean, it's not cut and dried. Like the reason I hesitate on I'm not completely sure if it's been completely identified as an isolate or how people within the community view it. I'm going to speak for them, because there are gray areas.
When you say a proto language has been reconstructed, how does that work?
So in the case of Indo-European, thousands and thousands of years ago, there were people who we call proto-Indo-Europeans. They certainly did not call themselves that, I'm sure, but they lived sort of in. I'm not going to call myself proto whatever, like that's going to be in 1,000 years, right? So there were people who spoke a language that is the parent language of all the Indo-European languages. They were probably located in kind of Ukraine, sort of in Russia, that kind of area. And they spread out through the entirety of Eurasia, like I say, to India. And so those languages developed from that parent language, but they still have a lot of similarities, and you can reconstruct cognates. And from the ways languages change, that's really interestingly predictable. So then you can reconstruct what that initial language would have been like. And that can tell you about what their culture was like and their knowledge systems as well. So it's really interesting. And we can do the same thing with the languages here. So the nice thing, or not nice, the really cool thing with that is often those linguistic recreations jive really well with our traditional histories, our oral histories that have been passed down. So we can actually affirm Western and Indigenous ways of knowing from one another in many cases.
So great. So you can, it's, I mean, you don't want to use the word proof, but it's kind of like it supports what, you know, what you have been told, right? From others in the community. And it's, you use the phrase ways of knowing, which is something I've come across, which is a really, really interesting, you know, like building a sort of like, what would you call it, like a knowledge base from Indigenous ways of thinking, right? So how does language sort of support that?
Think of language like a window, right? So I heard there's an elder named Paul Desan who's from Northern Saskatchewan, a Dene elder, who said language is the window through which we see the world. Mm-hmm. And so everything that you perceive, I believe, is filtered through your internal monologue and the way that things are explained to you. And so that is just really vital in terms of understanding culture in deep and meaningful ways. The reason that this should matter to everyone would probably relate to how traditional ontologies and epistemologies inform ecological knowledge. So I think it's fair to say, I think we'd all agree, that colonialism has been an absolute environmental disaster. Ideas such as domination over the earth and the earth is something through which things should be extracted, unbridled capitalism, those are ecological disasters, and they're leading us down a road that I don't think very many of us want to proceed down. Building an understanding of Indigenous traditional ecological knowledges is not an act of charity, right? It's actually something that is completely necessary because we lived on these lands for thousands of years prior to colonization and kept things in balance. And so I think that there's, again, a colonial mythology there that Indigenous people just lived in harmony with the earth and everything was fine and they were part of nature. And that's true to an extent, but there was work that went into that, right? So there was stewardship that went into ensuring that balance was continued, because balance and connection to the natural world in a non-hierarchical way is a part of Indigenous epistemology in most communities, as compared to like the hierarchy that's evident right through things like the Bible, right? So Adam was given earth. That's not how things are thought of, but it justifies really environmentally detrimental practices. So as we all come to understand traditional ecological knowledge a bit better, I think that it holds really important keys to moving us away from things like fossil fuels and climate change that are absolutely certainly things that are going to be destructive for all of us.
Yeah as you were saying, you know, it's actually written in the Bible that it's man's job to sort of to own land and to dominate it and to farm it, and it was, you know, land was absolutely taken away from people who were seen to not be doing that to God's will, which is obviously just madness. But yeah, if we're more able to think in terms of, you know, well, if this, even if it's something as seeing, well, if the rock is alive, the earth is alive, and we start thinking of it as, you know, part of our experience and our being as well, then yeah, maybe we'll appreciate things a bit differently. Your work, we spoke about your work in schools. Do you do much work online, reaching people, you know, you can't get to in person? Oh, especially now, I suppose.
Yeah, that's been an interesting challenge and gift with the pandemic. So I had done a bit of that before. I did a TED Talk a few years ago, which was a really tremendously intimidating experience.
I've seen it. You absolutely rocked it. It was amazing.
It was, I've never done anything quite like it. Anytime I watch a TED Talk now, I'm like, wow.
Did, how, How was it for you? Were you really nervous? Did they give you much sort of advice before you did it?
Yeah, that was really nice. So we had it was part of a TEDx event at Queen's. So now it's hosted on the mainstream TED site, which they do with certain talks. But we had a lot of really good coaching from primarily undergrad and graduate students who were invested in it. So they had done a lot of training and then helped us with the development of our talks, which was indispensable. And I really had a lot of respect for the knowledge that they were able to bring to us.
Amazing.
And I liked that too, because normally, like often we're in a teaching just to benefit from the expertise that those students had. But yeah, it was good. I wrote it. I also presented it to my community because some of the things that I talked about are about our local community and the community that I partner with on Manitoulin. So I ran things past them as well because I don't speak on behalf of. Everything is collaborative in our research. So I was really lucky to get to learn from people in our communities from that. Yeah, and then just do it.
He just went for it.
I was very lucky too. I had community members and friends in the audience, so the whole time I was talking to them, and that was really helpful.
What was the feedback like? Is this one of the things that you're sort of thinking about for outreach online?
I didn't think it would get that big. I didn't think that many people would watch it.
Like
So
over a
again,
million
that was
views now, right?
it's got over 1 million views, yeah. Yeah, that was very surprising. But mostly I just wanted to celebrate the work that we were doing because I'm really proud of how much we've accomplished in our local urban community. I'm really proud of our community. And I'm also really proud of what's been done in the communities that I work with, because it's just the amount of dedication work that goes into it is indescribable. And the amount of emotional labor and love that goes into it just makes me really proud to be Anishinaabe.
I feel very, very jealous, even of just friends who grew up in other countries, and everybody gets taught English as their second language. The majority of people get taught English as their second language. And as someone who's just English, I've always tried so hard. I've always got Duolingo, something going on. And I took languages right up into leaving school, and I'm passable in French and German, and I took Mandarin at uni as well. I just I appreciate, and then like I feel like, but as someone who rarely needs to use anything other than English, it's such a it's like fighting a wave coming in, It's like you really have to put so much effort and time into seeking out opportunities to speak other languages. And I mean, it's thankfully we do have these online resources and apps and online groups for bringing people together to speak the language. But it really is, to be something to be sort of celebrated, and particularly as the rife time for learning another language when you're a child in school is also the peak point of your potential embarrassment, where you don't want to get anything wrong and you don't want to stand out and you don't want to seem different in any way, right? Is that something that you've sort of had to battle with?
Yeah, and I think that's been a real benefit from some of the research that we've done with the local community in terms of having language reaffirm the importance of indigeneity for young people. Particularly here, like in Canada, we have a great deal of racism. It's very real. I think racism in the American context gets discussed a lot more, but anti-Black and anti-Indigenous racism in Canada is a very real lived experience for every Indigenous person and every Black person I've ever met. And so often Indigenous young people have challenges with respect to assimilation. And positive identity. So when we bring language into the community and demonstrate to them how wise it is and how important it is to ensure that its belonging is affirmed within our Indigenous urban community, it strengthens not just young people, but adults' identities and their pride in being Anishinaabe or Ganyangehe people or Ganyangehaga, sorry, Ganyangehaga people, or people of other nations, because our community is diverse. So I think language has such an important role there, but you're right, it's a double-edged knife because it also is a place where people can make mistakes and feel embarrassed. One of the things there that I see that I've heard people talk about that's really important is support from fluent speakers. And I've heard amazing fluent speaker teachers talk about how necessary it is that they validate our efforts as second language speakers. And I've had unbelievable support from the more fluent people that I know, right from like baby talk I spoke at the beginning to now maybe being able to have a decent conversation. Never once being mocked or laughed at. And as a mixed heritage person, having the validity of my Anishinaabe identity affirmed constantly has been really, really meaningful and valid. So it's all in our pedagogy, right? Like it's all in how we choose to present it to children, how we assess, how we affirm effort and celebrate growth versus having it presented as something that will be ranked and graded and put in that way, which can be really quite intimidating.
And this is this that sense of community and belonging and identity is obviously so strong, particularly I feel like in these cases. I've read some things about other more isolated, maybe more vulnerable languages that are being sort of like written down, you know, at the very last minute. We write them down whilst there's five speakers left sort of thing. But is that something that... that seems like maybe it's an approach that you wouldn't want to take, more like language should be the lived experience of speaking it.
Yeah, I've done language documentation. I think it's really important, but it's important because that can be the tool to breathe life back in. Mm-hmm. And so languages, I think a lot of people say go dormant rather than die because they're part of the land. But rather than getting to the point where dormancy is really imminent, doing the work pedagogically and in terms of curriculum development and appropriate assessment development so that it doesn't get to that point, having it in schools. And I've seen communities that one would think are in trouble move really quickly to ensure that it doesn't get to that point. I've seen efforts, for example, within our Haudenosaunee relatives community where the languages don't have as large a speaker base and don't have as many communities that are isolated and therefore more fluent, but they have put in unbelievable effort for documentation and self-determined education, and now there are young people, like children, who are first language speakers. So it just is not over until it's over, and that effort within communities is something that I think really needs to be praised. I'm grateful and really impressed at the work that they've done for that.
As we were saying, like, you know, language is, it's always changing as well. It's always changing, evolving. I suppose as well, the internet and social media has sort of shown us this, how, you know, it's not a given thing that's presented onto a population and we must all abide by its rules. People are affecting it and adapting it all the time, right? We're inventing new words and new meaning for words, liking and tagging and these sorts of things are all different now. What do you see as possibly the future of Indigenous languages? Do you think that they will go through anything similar?
Absolutely. We're all over Facebook. So one of my most important language learning communities is on Facebook. We write in Anishinaabemowin all the time. We use online tools to develop curriculum for our weekend language learning sessions. So right now we're using a platform called Trello to develop resources. And I've got recordings on there of songs that I'm going to teach next weekend about dancing skeletons. It's Halloween. So there's cultural mixing there too, right? Which I think is not a bad thing. One thing I've heard a lot of more fluent elders and teachers talk about is not borrowing, because English is very different phonologically, like the sounds are really different. And so when we borrow words in, it changes how the language is, and also structurally different. Like English has a lot more nouns, for example. So when a language comes into contact with a new concept, like say computer, it's important that a new term be coined rather than just saying computer in Anishinaabemowin. And sticking the English word in there, because that's when things become less reflective of Indigenous ways of knowing. But if English should come up with a word for computer, there's no reason we can't.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it comes from the word compute, which is maths. We, you know, in each language can sort of derive its own, make its own branch to that, to that word, right? Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. What's what is lies ahead for you in terms of research? You said you put a lot of your stuff on hold, but you're going back to some other projects. What are you excited about right now?
Oh, I'm so excited right now. I just finished writing a paper on why it really matters that Indigenous learners have Indigenous teachers. And that was a really uplifting paper to write. It made me just deeply appreciate the Indigenous educators that I'm surrounded by, both in the communities that I partner with, but also we've got just amazing community of Indigenous educators locally, who I love dearly. And it made me realize why that is. I mean, not that I didn't know, but it really affirmed that. I'm also writing a paper right now on why Indigenous languages and language revitalization in urban contexts is an act of decolonization. So it's a two-parter. I just finished the first bit, which looked at identity development as as the correlate to language revitalization. But I'm taking that a bit further now to look at how community identity development asserts Indigenous presence and is therefore an act of decolonization. So that'll be coming out. Hopefully by Christmas, I'll finish writing that one.
Amazing.
Yeah, and it's nice to be able to celebrate the work we've done. Yeah,
it keep coming back to that idea of community and the support of the people around you. And it seems like such an important part of it all.
It is, and that's what makes a person Indigenous, right? Like, of course you have to have heritage. Having heritage is a vital part of indigeneity, but it's not about a DNA test. Right, like being Indigenous is about the teachings you carry and the languages you learn or speak and how you live your life. And so in engaging community to affirm that, we affirm our ways of being Indigenous, which there are many ways to be Indigenous, but that's something that just doesn't change, is having community affirmation, community connection.
And the way that you said, like, a language won't die, it goes dormant because it's part of the land. That's something, that really struck me. That's beautiful. And I suppose it's the same with a lot of other of the parts of Indigenous culture, right? It's there. Mm. That's where it was made. That's where it was born. That's where it is. And it's just up to the people to sort of pass it along.
And it's true of any language, right? English is a part of England. And the way that the language is spoken is reflective of the land there. There was terms I didn't know when I came. Even things as simple as top of the road, right? Like, well, yes, when everything's on hills, there will be tops and bottoms of roads. the way dialect divides geographically and by class tells you a lot about English society. Those are not bad things. They're just reflections of how people view the world. So it's not unique. It's how all of our languages work. And I think that's something that needs to be celebrated because it gives us a lot of different ways of seeing.
Yeah, and clues to the past and clues to, you know, what people are thinking. And yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's very, very fascinating. Thank you so much for your time today. Email me your address and I will send you some mince pies, as I promised. Because it's Christmas. Why not?
I do miss it. Thank you. Take care.
Cool. And you.
Bye.
Bye.